kid, Jumping Jehoshaphat? Did you ever hear that? Okay, somebody else did it. Well, it's not just me. I have no idea what it means. And I've read nothing in the story of the biblical Jehoshaphat to indicate he's jumping, so I don't know. Anyway, his is one of the more peculiar names in the Bible. Curiously, most of what we have been studying in these kings is in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. But when you come to the story of Jehoshaphat, he just barely gets a blip in 1 Kings. He is vastly overshadowed by Ahab in the book of 1 Kings. So if you want to find out anything about Jehoshaphat, you have to go to the Chronicles. And he has four whole chapters devoted to his life and career there. So that's where we're going to be studying this evening. 2 Chronicles, chapter 17 through 20. And I entitled this one, Why Can't We All Get Along? Now, when do you usually hear that expression? Why can't we all get along? I'm sorry? Rodney King, yeah. Now, what does that expression usually suggest? There's a lot of discord going on, and surely there's a simple solution, right? We ought to be able to just kind of make all this discord and division go away. And that's this phrase I've used to apply to the career or the character of Jehoshaphat for reasons that should become very obvious as we get into the story of the man. And his is one of the more, I'll say disappointing stories in the Bible. He had such great potential as a king, and in fact did accomplish a great deal of good. But he had one serious character flaw that really sort of put a black pall over his record in the Bible. That's what we're going to be talking about this evening. So before we get started, Kent, could you direct our minds in prayer, please? Amen. Okay, we're going to start out by looking at all the good things that the book of 2 Chronicles says about Jehoshaphat. Let's start with a couple of passages. The first one is in the opening verses of chapter 17, and then the closing verses of chapter 20. And both of these are kind of a summation of the man and his life. Turn to 2 Chronicles 17. We're going to look at verses 2 through, what do I have up there? Well, I said, okay, 3 through 6. Now the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the former ways of his father David. He did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the acts of Israel. Therefore the Lord established the kingdom in his hand. And all Judah gave presents to Jehoshaphat, and he had riches and honor in abundance. And his heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he removed the high places and wooden images from Judah. Just from your own reading of this, pick out some things that stand out in your mind. What do you see there?
Sought after God.
He removed the idols. The Lord was with him. One of the things that stands out to me is in verse 3, he did not seek the Baals. Now, why is that significant? Baal worship was a very powerful influence during this period of time. What did we study last week? Ahab? And what was Ahab's claim to fame? He brought in Baal worship in the northern kingdom. And so, you know, God's people are already being drawn, attracted to this alternate form of worship. And Jehoshaphat resists that. He pushes away. He refuses to go down that path. Instead, he is seeking the Lord. His heart took delight in the ways of the Lord. So here's a man that, in fact, the statement is made very much like his forefather David. His heart is set on serving God, on doing the right thing. Now, look ahead, jump ahead to chapter 20. And right toward the end, this is verses 32 and 33. Again, another summary statement. He walked in the way of his father Asa and did not turn aside from it, doing what was right in the sight of the Lord. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for as yet the people had not directed their hearts to the God of their fathers. Did you catch a contradiction between this passage and the one we read in chapter 17? What is it? Deloitte, you were nodding your head. Okay. The passage in chapter 17 said that he removed the high places and wooden images. And this one in chapter 20 says the high places were not taken away. So how do you reconcile that? Well, but both of them are referring to the high places. He removed the high places and the high places were not taken away. Amy? Okay, yeah. And remember, the first one is at the beginning of his reign. This is kind of a summary of, you know, what he was at the beginning. The one in chapter 20 is kind of a summation at the end of his reign. The way I read this is that he started out at the beginning with great ambition, great intentions of removing the high places, and in fact probably did what he could to eliminate them. But he reigned for, I think it says, 25 years. And what are the chances of a king removing high places and they staying gone when he turns his back?
They've been in place for 60 years.
Yeah. So I really think this is not a hit on Jehoshaphat. I think he did what he could as a king. But as the passage in chapter 20 says, the people still had not, how does it put it? They had not directed their hearts to the God of their fathers. There's only so much one man can do, even if he is the king. He's done what he could to remove the high places, but as soon as he turns his back or leaves town, it goes back up again. And so the people have not really been turned away from them. That's the way I reconcile these, and maybe somebody else has another way of approaching that. But either way, what does this say about Jehoshaphat? I mean, what's your impression thus far?
Yeah,
he's a good man. Look in chapter 17 again, going back there, verses 7 through 9. Also, in the third year of his reign, he sent his leaders. Now, third year, where is this? If he reigned, I think it's 25 years. I should have highlighted that. I think it was 20-something years. So if this is the third year of his reign, where are we in his reign? Yeah, we're at the very beginning. He's had just enough time to kind of consolidate his power. So in the third year, he sends his leaders, blah, 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 you can read all those names yourself, to teach in the cities of Judah. And with them, he sent Levites and names these men. And then with them, Elisha, Am and Jehoram the priests. So they taught in Judah and had the book of the law of the Lord with them. They went throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. And notice that this teaching program or mission has been instigated by whom? The king, Jehoshaphat. Now, why would the king have an interest in the teaching of the law among his people? Because he loves the Lord, and other people ought to love him too. And this is very much a theocracy. We separate church and state today in our society. Back then, that didn't exist. The king had pretty much all the power that he needed. And in this case, he was using his authority to try to promote, actively promote, the teaching and the learning of the law. So does this go in the good column or the bad column? Very much good, yeah. You know, here's a man who really believed that the law of the Lord could be a positive benefit in his society. So he's trying to do what he can to promote it. Look in chapter 19 and verse 4. So Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again among the people from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim, and brought them back to the Lord God of their fathers. Now, you have to kind of understand your history and your geography here. Where's he going to bring people back to the Lord? Remember, he is the king of what two tribes?
Judah and Benjamin.
But where's he going? Where's Ephraim? It's the northern kingdom, right? There's another king in the north. And so basically what's happening is Jehoshaphat is kind of encroaching on the borders of the northern kingdom to try to bring some of those cousin Israelites back to the fold. Remember, why did the two kingdoms split to begin with? Yeah, a big tax uproar. And so Jehoshaphat took 10 tribes in one direction, Rehoboam took 2 tribes the other direction, and Jeroboam set up this alternate worship, remember that? Specifically to keep his people from going to Jerusalem. What's Jehoshaphat doing here? He's going to them. If they won't come to Jerusalem, then he will go to them and try to entice them, draw them back to the worship of God in Jerusalem. So, again, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Very much a good thing. Do you suppose this was a challenge for him? It had to be a big challenge. Yeah, because we're, you know, 2 or 3 generations into this division. A lot of these people are very comfortable where they're at, but that's not going to stop Jehoshaphat. Then look at chapter 19. We'll keep reading in verse 5. Then he set judges in the land throughout all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, "Take heed to what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judgment. Now therefore, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take care and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no partiality, nor taking of bribes." And then he goes on in verse 8, "Moreover, in Jerusalem, for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and priests and some of the chief fathers of Israel when they returned to Jerusalem. And he commanded them, saying, 'Thus you shall act in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a loyal heart. Whatever case comes to you from your brethren who dwell in their cities, whether of bloodshed or offenses against law or commandment, against statutes or ordinances, you shall warn them, lest they trespass against the Lord and wrath come upon you and your brethren. Do this, and you will not be guilty. Take notice, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebadiah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites will be officials before you. Behave courageously, and the Lord will be with the good." So what's Jehoshaphat doing here? What is he promoting now?
Justice.
It's important that justice be done. Is justice a big thing to God?
Yes.
That the right is rewarded and the wrong is punished, and that those standards be enforced impartially. You don't show partiality to the rich or to the poor or against the poor. And you know, justice has to be done. That is the basis, that's the foundation of a civil society. And Jehoshaphat the king knows that. And so now he's putting men in place who can be trusted to administer the law fairly, with justice. And there's not going to be any underhanded dealing, no bribes, no hanky-panky on the part of the people in power to line their own pockets, that's forbidden. No, these guys who are in position of making judgments among God's people, they're going to do it right according to God's standard. Okay, so is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? So what's your impression of Jehoshaphat thus far? Would you like to live in a kingdom with that kind of man sitting at the top? I mean, this is looking pretty good, isn't it? All right. Look in chapter 20. It just gets more remarkable the more we read this. I wish we had time to go through all of chapter 20. We're just going to have to hit some highlights here. Look at the first few verses of chapter 20. It happened after this that the people of Moab, with the people of Ammon and others with them, besides the Ammonites, came to battle against Jehoshaphat. And some came and told Jehoshaphat, saying, "A great multitude is coming against you from beyond the sea, from Syria. And they are in Hazazon Tamar, which is in Gedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. So Judah gathered together to ask help from the Lord, and from all the cities of Judah they came to seek the Lord." And then look down at verse 12. Jehoshaphat gathers all his people together and they pray to God. And then here is part of his prayer to God in verse 12. "O our God, will you not judge them," speaking of their enemies, "for we have no power against this great multitude that is coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are upon you." And then verse 18, "Jehoshaphat bowed his head with his face to the ground, and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem bowed before the Lord, worshiping the Lord." Now, verse 12 just really jumps out at me. Here you have the great king with all of his pomp and glory and majesty. And what is this man? Everybody in the kingdom honors him as the king. And what is the top man in the kingdom doing? He's submitting himself to the Lord, isn't he? He's acknowledging. In fact, look at that statement again in verse 12. "We have no power against this multitude." What king will admit to that? "I have no power here." Even if a king doesn't feel like he has the power, what is he probably going to do just to maintain appearances? He's going to bluff his way through it. You know, he can't let his mask slip, as it were, before the people. Jehoshaphat has no pretense of pride here. He freely recognizes and admits to God and to the people, "We don't have the power, we don't have the ability to stand up against this multitude that is coming up against us. Nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are on you." You know, Jehoshaphat is acknowledging the weakness of himself personally and his people, his kingdom, and how much they depend totally on God. What can God do with people like that? He can do an awful lot, right? Isn't humility really the basis of our relationship with God? If we don't have humility, He's not interested in us. Jehoshaphat has humility here. He's a good man. He's not a sniveling coward by any means. But he recognizes when he's in over his head. And clearly the enemy that has come up against them here is more than he can handle. He needs God's help. And so he knows in time of trouble, go to God. Pray to God. Cast your burden upon Him. Okay, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? I mean, you know, the character of this man just looms larger and larger as you get deeper into the story. And then, of course, just a couple of passages here talk about the result of this kind of man being at the top. He brought security and prosperity to Judah. We won't take the time to look at these two verses, but there are just several places through these chapters where it talks about the prosperity of the kingdom and the peace that the people enjoy. Here in chapter 20, of course, there was this threat from this foreign power. And by the way, without reading the rest of this chapter, you want to just make a wild guess what probably happened?
They weren't there.
He did come in and help them, and the way he came in to help them is really, well, I won't say it's unique, because there's another one or two places in the Bible where we read this happening. These allies that had come up against Jehoshaphat, the Lord set in motion confusion among these people. They started fighting each other to the point that the people of Judah didn't even have to raise a hand. In fact, these allies were so furious in fighting each other that it was a great slaughter, and the people of Judah came in after that battle, and there was just plunder for the taking, more than they could carry away. And so they weren't touched by these enemies. God took care of his people. And you can attribute it to the man at the top, the one who set the standard for how his people are to respond in times of trouble and distress. Great man, great man. Everything just really works like it ought to be. So, to this point, and obviously we're kind of cherry-picking information as we go through these chapters, right? To this point, everything about Jehoshaphat just looks fantastic. This is exactly what a king of God's people in the Old Testament ought to be. But let's look at the rest of the story. Twice in his career, Jehoshaphat sought alliances with the wicked kings of Israel. We talked about Ahab last week. Let's turn back and look at chapter 18, verses 1 through 3. Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, and by marriage he allied himself with Ahab. Now, I have reference to the details here in the next line. His son Jehoram married Ahab and Jezebel's daughter Athaliah. And if you know anything about the history of Judah, after both Ahab and Jehoshaphat departed the scene, Jehoram and Athaliah then become king and queen of Judah. Jehoram is swept off. What kind of daughter do you suppose Jezebel would have? Just make a wild guess. Is this the kind of woman you'd want your son to marry? I don't think so. And Athaliah proved to be every bit the witch that her mother was. And except now she's queen of Judah, the southern kingdom. And in fact, when she seized power, her husband died, she seized soul power and came this close to just annihilating the entire lineage of David, just wiping out the Davidic promise, had it not been for a woman who rescued a little baby and kept him alive for several years until Athaliah could be taken care of. The point is, Jehoshaphat's determination to have some kind of alliance with Ahab very nearly destroyed his own kingdom. Now, after he was gone, he didn't live to see this, but he's the one that set it in motion. He got this going. So he allied himself with Ahab by marriage. Now, let's just pose a question right here. Why do you suppose this good man did that? Did something so stupid? Okay, now link that to something we talked about a while ago. What was one of the initiatives that Jehoshaphat started that we said was a positive thing with regard to the northern kingdom? Yeah, he was trying to make overtures to the people in the northern kingdom, come back to the Lord, come back to Jerusalem. And that's a good thing. We can't fault him for that. But apparently, where did he cross the line in that effort? It wasn't just the people, the man on the street he was trying to reach. He was trying to go to the top. You know, we'll approach this king to king, right? Yeah, so, you know, maybe if my son marries his daughter, you know, some of the goodness here will rub off on them, right? Is that the way it works? Do you see now a hint of why I entitled this as I did? Can't we all get along? It seems to be Jehoshaphat's whole approach to the thing. The king, God's people at this time were divided, terribly divided, and it was a bad thing. It was destructive for both nations. And it just bothered Jehoshaphat that this condition existed. And in his mind, good man that he was, he wanted to see people united again. But how did he go about trying to do it? Yeah, just basically pretend that it doesn't exist. Pretend that there are no real differences between us and, you know, start intermarrying and getting cozy and buddy-buddy. And the rest of chapter 18, we didn't finish reading this. In verse 2, after some years, he, Jehoshaphat, went down to visit Ahab in Samaria. Ahab killed sheep and oxen in abundance for him and the people who were with him. Now, what's that? Killing sheep and oxen for Jehoshaphat. What's that? How's Ahab treating him? As an honored guest, right? So what does Ahab think of this effort to try to get close? He's okay with that. Yeah, he's cool with that. After all, Ahab, as we saw last week, is having problems with the Syrians. And so what benefit might accrue to Ahab in getting close to Jehoshaphat and all his military power? I can use this man and his military. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Look in verse 3. Ahab, king of Israel, said to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "Will you go up with me against Ramoth Gilead?" And notice how Jehoshaphat responds. "I am as you are, and my people as your people. We will be with you in this war." So this was not Jehoshaphat's war. His borders did not, you know, Israel was kind of a buffer between him and Syria. And yet when Ahab approaches Jehoshaphat with this deal, you know, "Why don't you go with me to war against the Syrians?" What's Jehoshaphat's reaction? Yeah, that's fine. So we're all Israelites, we're all brothers, so this is fine. We ought to be in this together. Well, but what's he setting up his people for? As it turned out, in this battle, it didn't go so good. In fact, Ahab ends up getting killed. I just make mention here, we don't have time to look at it in detail. This third sub-bullet, he allowed himself to be exposed before the enemy in battle. Read those verses there, and this will just shock you. Before they go into battle, Ahab tells Jehoshaphat, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to dress in just, you know, the normal garb of a soldier. And you, Jehoshaphat, I want you to ride in your chariot in all your royal splendor in front of your troops." Who are the Syrians going to go after? Yeah. Ahab gets it, you know, in the end. God takes care of Jehoshaphat against his own better judgment. But why in the world would a king allow himself to, you know, be set up as a target like that in the middle of a battle? I don't get it. Now, so you can see the direction that I'm going here. We started out talking about what a great man Jehoshaphat was, and he was. You know, to a large extent, he was one of the best kings that Judah had ever had since David. And yet, there was something about his character that he had a hard time discerning between that which was noble and right and good and justified and that which was just stupid. And there were some of these things that were just dumb. And he just could not recognize how marrying off his son to the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel would be a bad thing. He just could not see the bad that would come from that. Or what, you know, Ahab sets him up for in this battle. I mean, none of this just really makes any sense. Look also in chapter 20, in verse 35. After Ahab dies, "After this, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, allied himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, who acted very wickedly, and he allied himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish. And they made the ships in Ezion-Geber. But Eleazar, the son of Dodavah of Meresheth, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, 'Because you've allied yourself with Ahaziah, the Lord has destroyed your works.' And so the ships were wrecked." You know, I don't think I even have this up here. I don't. Oh, yeah, we do. I skipped over it. Look in chapter 19, verses 1 through 3. It's an appropriate place to bring it up. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem after this battle that went so badly. And Jehu, the son of Hananiah, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Nevertheless, good things are found in you, in that you have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God." So after all of the good that Jehoshaphat has done, what's the conclusion of the prophet that comes to him? "Yeah, you have really blown it here, guy." The Lord gives him credit. "You've done a lot of good things here. But in this regard, you know, what he is doing is just beyond foolish. And trying to cozy up to somebody like Ahab and Jezebel. He has good intentions. He wants God's people to be reunited again. But you can't reunite with somebody who's dead set against the Lord." And that's what Jehoshaphat was trying to do. And that brings us then to the last page here, applying what we've learned. Success is in our relationship with God, not in our own strength. This is one of the positives we draw from Jehoshaphat, that prayer to the Lord as they were facing this great multitude that's coming up against them, how he freely acknowledged his limitations and his weaknesses. And as a king back in those days, that was huge. That was a big deal. Those kings just weren't very humble men. But Jehoshaphat was. I mean, he recognized that we need the Lord, and he had no compunction at all about going to God for the help that he needed. That's a good thing. But the second lesson here is there is a big difference between reaching out to the lost and supporting the wicked. And that, to me, is one of the great lessons that we can draw from the story of Jehoshaphat, and especially in our day today. Is it bad that those who claim to be Christians are as horribly divided as they are today? Yes or no? Is that a bad thing before the world?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's horrible. It just makes a mockery of the prayer that Jesus prayed in John 17 before he died. Jesus prayed that those who believe on me through their word, that they will be one, even as you and I are one. And do those who wear the name Christian today honor that prayer? Not at all. So what is the temptation on our part? Well, naturally, would we like all of those who claim to be Christians to be united together? Of course. So how do we go about that? Well, seriously, you know, Jehoshaphat was half right in taking the law to those people in the northern kingdom. You know, here is what God has said in His Word, and people need to return to this. But he went beyond that effort and just started ignoring the differences. And he just went ahead and, you know, kind of merged more or less with Ahab and Jezebel, and the character of this northern kingdom was just abominable. And Jehoshaphat just kind of, you know, pretended it wasn't there. And we'll be united anyway. And it did not end well. So it's an important lesson that we need to understand today. Unity is a great thing, and we should strive for unity. But we need to recognize there's a limit as to what kind of compromises we can make in trying to achieve that. And then finally, even when our trouble is due to our own poor decision-making, we can still call out to God for help. We didn't spend much time on this, but in that battle where we were describing, you know, Jehoshaphat was the only one of the two kings that went in with his royal regalia. Naturally, the archers went after him, and he cried out to God in the midst of this battle, and God delivered him. Now, it was his own stupidity that got him in this jam, but even then, God helped him and delivered him from certain death. Has there ever been a time in your life when you've done something pretty stupid, and after the fact you realized it, and you ask God's help in dealing with the aftermath? You know, it's a pretty humbling experience, isn't it? And Jehoshaphat's a good example of that. Anyway, I thought this might be one of the more interesting topics that we've been looking at in this quarter. Next week, we're going to look at Jehu. And this is not the same Jehu that we just read about, the prophet that came to Jehoshaphat and chewed him out for what he was doing. I call this one zeal for self. And that's based on a statement that Jehu himself made about himself, that he had a great zeal for God. And how he showed that zeal is a little iffy. And we'll talk about that next week. Any other questions? Comments? Thank you very much.